You put a big black blob in the middle of Canada, and you reach out a tentacle to every part of the coast. There's a giant octopus that's essentially wrapping its tentacles around North America.
I find it marvelous how people can somehow drive down a 18-lane freeway in their SUV, cursing and swearing about products of the oil sands coming to California. As Pogo said, we've seen the enemy and he is us.
First Nations are saying, we understand there has to be economic development, but the way that the federal government is expanding the tar sands is just way out of control.
You're listening to Fighting Goliath, a story about the frenetic exploitation of the Canadian tar sands and its rippling effects across the continent. The Canadian tar sands is the largest industrial project on Earth. These deposits of a sand-embedded solid form of low-grade oil, located in the northeast corner of Alberta, cover an area the size of Florida. Everything about the extraction of tar sands is enormous, sprawling open-pit mines collectively the size of a large metropolitan area, mining equipment the height of a three-story building, toxic tailings ponds that can be seen from outer space. But people far from Alberta are also starting to feel the effects of the tar sands' massive footprint. In the winter of 2010, people along Highway 12 in north-central Idaho first learned that their community was about to become one of the tendrils of the tar sands.
One of my board members who has a business up on U.S. Highway 12 said that I just heard a rumor there were some giant loads that were going to be hauled through here, and can you check into this for me?
Kevin Lewis is the conservation director for Idaho Rivers United, based in Boise, Idaho, 200 miles south of Highway 12.
I got in touch with local residents. They had, in fact, just recently suffered a power outage.
One of the linemen told me that they were raising all the power lines along U.S. 12 because an oil company was going to be bringing big loads through.
Lynn Woodlahi is a resident and activist in the Clearwater Valley of north central Idaho.
So I drove into Lewiston and went to the Idaho Transportation Department, and they said, yes, this was going to happen.
The Imperial Oil modules were headed from South Korea, where they had been built, to the tar sands of Alberta, Canada.
Borg Hendrickson lives with her husband, Lynn Lahey, in the wild and scenic Clearwater Corridor.
We had never heard of the tar sands before. We have since learned a lot about the tar sands.
Attempts to exploit tar sands deposits along the Athabasca River in northeastern Alberta date back decades. But the process of turning the tar-like bitumen contained in the tar sands into a useful product is extremely expensive and energy-intensive. So there was no financial incentive to expand tar sands production as long as the price of oil remained low.
In the late 1990s, as the price of oil started to rise, and it was becoming obvious to a lot of people that the era of light, cheap oil was coming to a close, there was a gold rush. And every major oil company on the planet secured a lease or mining operation.
Andrew Nikiforuk is a writer and journalist living in Calgary and author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent.
Canada was producing maybe 500,000 barrels of bitumen a year. By 2005, we were up to 1 million barrels.
Our forecast sees that going from about 2 million barrels a day today.
Greg Stringham with the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers.
To just close to 5 million barrels a day by the year 2035.
The vast deposits of bitumen in the Canadian oil sands were originally light, sweet crude oil.
Bob Skinner, interim director of the Canada School of Energy and the Environment in Calgary.
But it has degraded by bacteria chewing away at the hydrogen atoms and oxidation by water.
Bitumen really just is a fancy word that means oil that won't flow to a well by itself.
The challenge with bitumen making it into a useful product is that we have to reverse all those geological and natural processes and geological time over millions of years. And of course, we're going to concentrate that in, geologically speaking, a nanosecond. And that takes energy and it takes resources, takes water, manpower.
The boreal forest under which these bitumen deposits rest are the continent's northern lungs. They sequester enormous amounts of carbon and they breathe enormous amounts of oxygen. The muskeg, which is the swampy parts, hold these incredible peat bogs that have sequestered carbon for nearly 10,000 years. When you come along with a mining operation and you start draining these swamps and then digging them up, you're digging up 10,000 years of work by Mother Nature.
They take oil sands out with very large trucks and shovels, then drive across the mine to a central processing facility. They add water, and then they can put that slurry of sand and oil and water into a pipeline that moves it up to the separation facilities. The oil is scraped off the top, and it's then moved through an upgrader to change it from heavy oil into light oil.
These open pit mines are among the largest open pit mines in the world, and they're all located on either side of the Athabasca River. You have all this clay and hydrocarbon deposits and heavy metals that is deposited in tailings ponds, these huge lakes that are raised above the landscape about 100 meters high. We really don't know, once we've destroyed this forest, how to put it back together in any sense that would resemble the wonderful natural capital that was once there.
The current tar sands boom in Alberta is part of a Western tradition of boom and bust economies. In Idaho and Montana, frenetic resource extraction goes back to the 19th century.
Montana, for a long time, was basically owned by Anaconda corporate interests. People literally with money bags going to the state capital in Helena and passing out the goods.
Onyx Smith is a writer and filmmaker living in Montana's Blackfoot Valley.
Anaconda started mining copper in Butte, late 19th century. First, it was underground mines, and eventually most of the city collapsed into the pit, and then they did strip mining until they could get cheaper copper in Chile.
After the Anaconda Company began to lose some of its power, the Montana Environmental Policy Act was the first act of a rebellious people.
Bob Gentry is an attorney in Missoula, Montana.
And in 1972, Montana rewrote Montana's constitution to include fundamental right of all Montanans to a clean and healthful environment.
Since then, of course, we've been going slowly, slowly, slowly back to the old corporate mining, get what you can and get out philosophy. Now we've got the fracking going on in eastern Montana. Again, as soon as the gas runs out and the oil runs out, that's going to be ghost country again.
Like Montana, much of Idaho's history has been dominated by exploitation of the state's vast timber and mineral riches. So in 2010, it was no surprise that state officials welcomed Imperial Oil's proposal to haul shipments of gigantic mining equipment across the state.
Imperial Oil had proposed bringing 207 loads.
Clearwater Corridor resident Lynn Lahey.
They were 29 feet 11 inches high and two-thirds the length of a football field.
Some of the megaloads are as much as 28 feet wide.
Kevin Lewis, Idaho Rivers United.
So on like Highway 12, which is just a two-lane winding mountain road, the really wide loads overhang the entire highway and the shoulders of the highway.
Sections of the Clearwater-Locksaw Corridor were not even paved until the 1970s. There's a better than 100-mile stretch without any gas stations, restaurants, or human services of any kind.
Stephen Hawley is a writer from Hood River, Oregon.
It's by designation that these areas have stayed wild and scenic. And the mistake that Imperial Oil made was just assuming that those laws didn't mean anything to people.
This is my road. I've lived on it for 20 years.
Montana writer David James Duncan, reading from his essay, The Heart of the Monster.
Big Oil is asking its drivers to drag 650,000-pound loads over highways rated for 80,000, over bridges made of aged creosoted timbers, and over aged concrete and steel. The rigs will be crossing underground sewers, gas lines, power lines, water mains. When damage occurs, it will be unseen till the loads are long gone, so locals will suffer the consequences and pay for the repairs.
In the summer of 2010, Idaho Department of Transportation and Imperial Oil said, hey, this is what we're doing, it's a done deal.
The public resistance started rising and they began to realize that they really needed to have some public meetings.
I got a phone call from this woman from Missoula who said, there's a meeting in Kuski, Idaho, and your name came up as a writer who might want to come to this meeting. I get there and it's a packed house. Imperial Oil representatives were clearly not expecting this many people to be at the Kuski Town Hall.
It had been billed as a meeting. People were angry because they said, when does the meeting start? And they'd say, we're not having one. I went to an ITD employee that I'd been dealing with and they said, people are starting to leave and so I think you should have a meeting because otherwise people are going to go away angry. And he said, no, Linwood, we're not having a meeting.
And the next excuse was, well, we don't have a public address system. And then Lynn said, I have one. I'll set it up now. The half dozen Imperial Oil representatives proceeded to sit and listen for the next 2 hours about what folks in Kuski thought about this idea of turning their river corridor into an industrial corridor.
When asked how Imperial Oil would deal with a tip-over and dumping of a module into the Locksaw River, Imperial spokesman Dan Johnson told the public, we could have a crane up here from Spokane in 10 hours.
David James Duncan from The Heart of the Monster.
What Johnson failed to mention is that no crane of this size is available in Spokane, that a 500-ton crane is an even more problematic transportation problem than the module it would set out to retrieve, and that a crane can only tilt 20 degrees from vertical, so it couldn't reach out over the rivers to retrieve the module anyway.
After the Kuski meeting, the grassroots network Lynn and Borg had started, Rural People of Highway 12 Fighting Goliath, continued to grow.
Our website, fightinggoliath.org, was intended not as much to inspire resistance as to provide information, because we were convinced that the information was overwhelmingly convincing all by itself.
Meanwhile, Idaho Rivers United, along with the Nez Perce tribe, through whose land the giant trucks would travel, petitioned the Forest Service to block the megaloads from entering the Clearwater National Forest. The Forest Service claimed they had no authority to block the megaloads, spurring the two groups to sue the Forest Service and the Federal Highway Administration in federal court for failing to protect the wild and scenic river corridor. Word of the megaloads spread to Missoula, Montana in early 2010.
This was an invitation from the oil producers in Canada to become involved in the tar sands issue.
Zach Porter is a Missoula environmental activist.
Because for all the times that they call us meddlers from the United States, when they bring their project right through our main streets, it's our issue.
Soon after Zach heard about the megaloads, the Montana Department of Transportation held a public meeting in Missoula to inform the community about the plan to move the enormous loads through Montana. More than 250 people showed up to learn that the project was pretty much a done deal.
Representatives from Imperial Oil were sitting in the middle of one of the local elementary school basketball courts. Meanwhile, public officials from the Montana Transportation Department, the people who really should have been answering to the public, were hiding off in a corner somewhere.
I was really incensed about the way that they just disregarded everybody's comments at this meeting.
Steve Senninger is an economist at the University of Montana.
Whether it was about the economics, about the environment, about travel problems.
What just didn't make any sense was why they would have settled on this route. By digging with the help of attorney Bob Gentry, we learned this route was chosen because it was the only way to get these modules from the West Coast to the tar sands without going under an overpass.
It became apparent to me that this route was not selected by Montana Department of Transportation, but was instead selected by contractors of Imperial Oil.
After the Missoula meeting, Zach Porter got involved with a group called the No Shipments Network. At weekly meetings, they planned strategies to stop the megaloads. Their first action was a demonstration on Reserve Street, a major artery that the megaloads would travel on their way through Missoula. Meanwhile, Susan Estep, who is connected with the Women's Donor Network, pulled together people with financial and professional connections. She held a meeting at her house where she met Spider McKnight, a longtime activist and communications specialist. Susie immediately recruited Spider to do messaging and publicity for the incipient campaign.
I saw in the paper they were having a demonstration on Reserve Street, and I went there and I was like, okay, I'm going to find an organizer here. And I was watching the crowd, and then there was this really articulate young man with a bullhorn, and I was like, that's our guy. And it turned out to be Zach Porter.
We began to work with some attorneys.
Susan Estep, co-founder of All Against the Hall.
We connected with the folks in Idaho who were doing work there, and of course they were ahead of us by many, many, many months.
Attorneys working with All Against the Hall recruited and trained community members to submit comments during the public comments period that opened after the environmental assessment was published. Among those testifying at the hearings was economist Steve Senninger, who countered the argument that the project would create much-needed jobs for the region.
These are rural areas where unemployment is high. When these projects come along and they dangle the promise of employment in front of folks, local county commissioners, out-of-work people react to that and say, well, here's something that's going to save us.
There are no jobs from these projects. These are outside companies. They bring their workers and their equipment. Yeah, they'll stay in a motel room a few times or buy a pack of cigarettes at the smoke shop.
Kevin Lewis, Idaho Rivers United.
A huge component of the economy of that river canyon is the river canyon itself and the tourism that it brings. And that's the sort of thing that you will run off with moving megaloads to the river corridor.
We created a coalition, All Against the Hall, and it was all about the all.
We said, we're not going to start this by going out and telling people what this is about. We're going to go and ask people what they think it's about.
We met with ranchers, we met with farmers, we met with the Square Dance Center along the highway.
This annoyed people who were the most ardent right-wing property rights activists, as well as people on the far left who were up in arms about the Canadian tar sands. Our job was to bring them all together.
I thought it was a wonderfully ironic moment when this rancher was talking about how these people, they just think they can come over and go through our land and take what they want and do what they want and make it their own. And I remember the native man I was next to looking over at him, and we both sort of chuckled. And then the rancher looked at him, and there was this profound moment of understanding right there.
Susan Estep brought together artists, writers, local conservation organizations, people from all over Montana and some from outside of the state.
I heard about it from Susie Estep, who is a friend of mine.
Onyx Smith is one of a number of well-known writers who have made Montana their home. Montana's natural history is the backdrop for much of what they write about, and over the years, many of these writers have taken stands to protect the values that attracted them to Montana.
Susie Estep had the sense to know us and to say, okay, we can use these people. They're not the best organizers in the world, they don't have a lot of money, but they can write.
Onyx wrote an open letter to Governor Brian Schweitzer, published in newspapers throughout Montana in October 2010.
Dear Governor Brian Schweitzer, I remember the stirring speech you gave at the Democratic National Convention in 2008.
We face a great new challenge, a world energy crisis that threatens our economy, our security, our climate, and our very way of life. We need to break America's addiction to foreign oil. We need a new energy system that is clean and green and American-made.
That day, I was proud of my governor for being on the side of the future. Now, I'm not so proud. These days, you say, we need energy and the safest supply right now is coming from places like Alberta, meaning the dirtiest type of fossil fuel extracted from the tar sands. And then you say, this is conflict-free oil. I'm afraid, Governor, that Alberta's tar sands oil is in no way conflict-free. Putting aside big-time environmental objections, let's focus on conflicts in Montana. The equipment necessary to mine and extract tar sands oil is gigantic. It is manufactured in Asia. Super trucks are needed to haul super machines, and the shortest, cheapest way to haul them from South Korea to Alberta is across the Pacific, up the Columbia and Snake Rivers, then overland through Idaho and Montana. We will be the sacrifice zone for super profits for multinational corporations. Their plans, which your administration seems to be backing, would transform Highway 12, a national scenic byway along the Clearwater and Lockaw Rivers, and Highway 200 along the world-famous river that runs through it, into a permanent industrial corridor. Every night for who knows how many months, giant mechanical beasts will traverse our countryside and pass through towns. They will delay emergency services and local traffic, depress property values, destroy historic and archaeological sites, and harm tourism and recreational businesses that are the lifeblood of our communities. But we don't have to be a colonial state. Please, Governor, return to your call for green energy and help the concerned citizens of Montana stop the big rigs from running over us.
Because my good friend David James Duncan lives on Highway 12, I called him up and said, David, you have to help us. He said, don't talk to me. I can't do this. I'm writing a novel. I said, David, you have to do it. This is your road. This is your river.
Susie Estep persuaded David, who then recruited fellow Montana writer Rick Bass, to co-author a rapid response book about the megaloads.
The rigs were coming in 2 months. As crazy as it was, we had to try to produce a book in 2 months. We knew that any book publisher we approached would tell us we were absolutely out of our minds. So our publisher became All Against the Hall.
Oregon writer Stephen Hawley traveled the megalode route with David and Rick and researched the book's source material.
We named the book The Heart of the Monster, based on a Nez Perce creation legend.
The Nez Perce creation myth centers around a unique rock formation along the route of the megalodes.
That is supposedly the heart of a great monster that once consumed every creature on Earth. The last creature left outside the monster was Coyote. Coyote allowed himself to be eaten by the monster, and when he got inside, he started a fire that cooked the monster's heart and then cut the heart loose. The monster's heart fell on the ground, and that is that pile of basalt rubble right by Highway 12 in Idaho. The Nez Perce people were created when they climbed out of that rubble.
These trucks were sort of a modern-day monster that had to be stopped. And we liked that metaphor well enough that we asked the Nez Perce if we could use it for the title of the book, and they said yes.
The book became the cornerstone of the campaign, finding its way onto the desks of Governor Brian Schweitzer, Montana Senator John Tester, and other political leaders, and into the hands of activists and donors across the country. David Duncan painted a vivid picture of the scale and scope of the ecological disaster that the gigantic trucks would help create.
The tar sands of Alberta are displacing one of the last great planetary preserves of avian fecundity, with a second Gulf of Mexico-like disaster to the north. On April 8, 2008, the bodies of 1,606 dead waterfowl were scooped from a Syncrude tailings pond. Syncrude's effluent pond is formed by the second largest dam on Earth. The massive sludge reservoir this dam encloses is poison central. The reservoir is located amid the ancient nesting grounds of millions of waterfowl and other birds. During a blinding early morning snowstorm, the birds were forced to rely on migratory memory and landed on the Death Lake. The industry's idea of a warning system: when a flock of waterfowl flies close to the biggest reservoirs, a cannon might fire. On the morning of the 1,606 duck kill, the cannon didn't fire because it was snowing. A Syncrude spokesperson later acknowledges on film that the actual number of birds killed that morning or any morning is impossible to determine because mired birds sink fast in the sludge.
Industry and government, in retrospect, were extremely remiss in not dealing with the tailings issue and the reclamation more aggressively.
Bob Skinner, Canada School of Energy and the Environment.
This necessitated the government to institute some pretty severe regulatory actions and directives.
Ducks had to die on tailings ponds before the Alberta government got embarrassed enough to really say, we need to do something with these tailings and be more proactive.
Writer Andrew Nikiforuk.
Not one company has met the standards that were set up by the province a couple years ago. There's no punishment, there's no outcry, there's no nothing.
In response to bad publicity generated by tailings ponds and other environmental damage, the Canadian oil industry created the Canadian Oil Sands Innovation Alliance, known as COSIA, which encourages companies to share technologies they hope will solve these problems. Dan Wicklum is the chief executive of COSIA.
All sectors in the world are being asked by the public to get better and better on their environmental performance. So it just makes good business for the companies to do the right thing.
Today at Syncrude, which started in 1978, they've reclaimed about 20% of the overall land that they have disturbed as part of this mining process.
Greg Stringham, Vice President of Markets and Oil Sands with the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers.
A very small area has been certified and given back to the government because the government doesn't want to take that land back until they're sure that the trees are growing, the wildlife's returned.
Some of the areas that have been reclaimed were actually very easy to reclaim. They weren't tailings ponds, they weren't huge mining pits. They were simply the dirt that they rolled up at the beginning of the mine site. They would move this dirt around, they planted trees in it, and then claimed that, look how easy reclamation is to do up here.
There's no question there's much, much more landscape that has been disturbed compared to reclaimed. But over the course of time, as you disturb landscape, you reclaim parts of the landscape behind yourself, and you can squeeze and close that gap between the amount of landscape that's disturbed versus reclaimed.
In many cases, they're finding it difficult to restore the forest, and so what they're really restoring is grassland. Nobody is replacing the peat bogs and muskeg that they have destroyed because physically they don't know how to do it. They're getting away with practices in northern Alberta in terms of wetland destruction that they wouldn't be allowed to get away with anywhere else in North America.
The proposed heavy haul corridor through Idaho and Montana is just one of the tendrils of the tar sands that include inputs and outputs stretching across Canada, through the heartland of the United States, down the Pacific coast, and across the Northern Rockies and Pacific Northwest.
ExxonMobil had identified Highway 12 as the route to the tar sands, and the word spread among big oil companies that, hey, Exxon's got this road getting ready for us.
Borg Hendrickson, Fighting Goliath.
There was no question that they intended for this to become a permanent industrialized route to the tar sands.
Before Imperial ExxonMobil had secured the needed permits to haul its 200 megaloads through Idaho and Montana, ConocoPhillips received permission to haul a single megaload headed to a mine in Billings, Montana, along part of the same route. Lynn Lahey and Borg Hendrickson organized residents along the route to monitor the load from Lewiston into Montana.
Our full intention was simply to be a car on the road. We were not protesting, we were not obstructing, we were not getting arrested, but it wasn't long before we realized these aren't our state police. The state police are working for a Canadian oil company.
They would pull over monitors and tell them if they came through the load again, they would be pulled over and arrested.
They went through and put no parking signs and cones on every turnout on Highway 12 for over 100 miles.
So the megaloads blocked access to all the beaches, trails, and campgrounds along the river and created a rolling roadblock that stopped emergency responders and people on their way to the hospital. After much delay and hassle, the trucks made it over Lolo Pass, the border between Idaho and Montana, and drove into Missoula.
The trucks came through in the middle of the night.
Spider McKnight, All Against the Haul.
There was a protest and we all went out. It was pitch black. And then out of the darkness came these blinding lights. And you didn't know what was behind them. All you could see was light coming at you. And from really high up, as it got closer, you saw these round shadows behind these big lights. It felt like an invasion.
Jim Lynch, head of the Montana Department of Transportation, was pushing to expedite the permitting process for the megaload project. Meanwhile, attorney Bob Gentry was busily following the paper trail.
One of the things that attracted my attention were presentations that Director Jim Lynch had made in the summer of 2009.
We are actually setting the stage for a high, wide corridor through the state of Montana to be used probably for things that we haven't even imagined yet. We're talking about 200 to 500 loads, and that is a significant impact to the state.
By April, the Department of Transportation had published an environmental assessment that said there were no significant impacts.
There are impacts. We don't feel that they're significant. So we're fairly confident they'll be able to demonstrate to the department that the environmental impact is minor, and they may have a very small environmental assessment to prepare for us before we can issue a permit.
So something changed between July of 2009 and September of 2009 to put this project on the fast track.
The Montana Department of Transportation released their finding, which concluded that ExxonMobil's megaload project would have no significant impacts and could go ahead as proposed. Lawyers with All Against the Haul believed that this decision violated the Montana Environmental Policy Act. Once the finding was signed, the Montana Sierra Club, Montana Environmental Information Center, and the National Wildlife Federation filed a lawsuit against the MDT. Their case was greatly strengthened when a critical partner stepped up.
The Missoula County Commissioners came forward saying we oppose this project and we are interested in doing whatever it takes to make sure that the law is followed because this could have very significant impacts to Missoula County residents.
People know about the trucks and they know that there's this lawsuit going on, and all of a sudden the Yellowstone pipeline burst. Oil coming from Canada started polluting the Yellowstone River, and people had to evacuate their homes, and there was major cleanup, and we lost fish and birds.
This morning, Montana's governor says ExxonMobil is just guessing at the amount of damage from the spill and is downplaying the environmental effect. ExxonMobil disagrees, saying pollution is limited mostly to a 10-mile area near Billings.
In the end, Governor Brian Schweitzer came to oppose the project.
Zach Porter, executive director of All Against the Haul.
I think he realized that it was a bigger political liability than it was worth.
I don't think that we would have seen capitulation from Brian Schweitzer if we had not had the Yellowstone River spill.
Susie Estep, All Against the Haul.
Exxon was very slow to respond. They were extremely difficult to work with, and I think Brian Schweitzer got mad and realized that this was not a good game to play.
Imperial Oil wanted to ship through the corridor what they called a test validation module, one large load to prove that they could do it.
Kevin Lewis, Idaho Rivers United.
And things didn't go as smoothly as they thought they would go. They ended up snagging a guy wire to a power pole and disrupting the power to over 1,000 residents. Then it was parked for 2 weeks while they went along and trimmed more trees through the Wild and Scenic River corridor.
It came to light that Imperial Oil was doing something it said it couldn't do.
Attorney Bob Gentry.
At the Port of Lewiston, it was cutting these modules in half, making them short enough that they could go under overpasses and bridges along the interstate system.
Because the Montana Department of Transportation had misled the court by claiming there was no way to cut down the loads and ship them by a different route, the judge ruled against the MDT and placed an injunction against any further megaload shipments through rural roads in Montana.
The judge in Montana allowed this test validation module into Montana only as far as the first private place they could park it.
So it was stuck up at Lolo Pass for quite a while and became kind of a tourist attraction. People would go and be like, here's the stuck truck, and it's never going to go through.
In June 2012, Imperial Oil withdrew its megaload permit applications, saying they had finished transporting all their modules to northern Alberta by freeway. But as it turned out, at quite a cost.
Imperial Oil said that they were over budget by $2 billion and behind schedule.
Each one of those modules that they had to change cost them an additional $500,000.
Writer Stephen Hawley.
Each day that they didn't have this equipment there to start refining bitumen in Alberta was also costing them money.
I wish I could say that this was about stopping the tar sands. It was about stopping the trucks.
Spider McKnight, all against the haul.
We knew that there's a lot of ways that can get to the tar sands, and if we stop it, they'll probably just go to another community. But we wanted to find ways to make a model of how other communities could fight it, because we see each little arm as a tendril in the octopus. We'll just cut off one arm at a time.
In late spring 2013, the megaloads threatened to start again. This time, the hauler, Omega Morgan, planned to transport even more enormous loads over the same route. But opponents had on their side a federal judge's ruling on the lawsuit filed by Idaho Rivers United and the Nez Perce that the Forest Service did have authority to regulate megaloads.
When these three Omega Morgan loads came to Lewiston, the Forest Service told Omega Morgan that they were not authorized to use Highway 12 in the Clearwater National Forest. The problem was then the Forest Service just stepped back and let them do it. We felt that the Forest Service has the tools available to enforce its decisions. They were just at that point were choosing not to use those tools.
We're on Highway 12, and we're right at the boundary of the Nez Perce Indian Reservation. I believe this whole crowd is going to walk out into the highway and stand in front of the megaload.
We've tried to go through policy that's been established, and they've neglected to follow that policy.
Silas Whitman, Nez Perce Tribal Chair.
This is the only way for our voice to be heard, and we're willing to go to whatever lengths, including jail if necessary. We have a responsibility to speak on behalf of this earth and our resources that we have sworn to protect.
It took a lot to force the Nez Perce tribe to finally think they had to go out and actually stop the load in the middle of the highway. This was the first really large protest, and it went on for the entire 4 nights that this load was moving through that part of Idaho. The judge ordered the Forest Service to do what we had asked them to do previously. Forest Service did it. Their position is the closure order wouldn't survive a court challenge, but right now there is a closure on Highway 12 written by the Forest Service.
Despite the closure of Highway 12, the megaloads keep coming. Since December 2013, three more megaloads have been barged up the Columbia River to the port of Umatilla, where they began a circuitous overland route to the tar sands across eastern Oregon, southern Idaho, and Montana, meeting protesters and communities along the way. You're listening to Fighting Goliath. In the second half of this program, we look at two more tendrils of the tar sands, stretching from Alberta across the Canadian Rockies to the Pacific coast of British Columbia.
Themselves, our grandchildren, and all of the generations after. We have to ensure that they get to have salmon and clean water. One thing I want to ask those corporations, do you think that you don't breathe the same air that we breathe? Let me tell you something, you do.
We're only weeks away from what Stephen Harper thinks will be his final decision on the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. We're holding this rally to say, if you don't stop this pipeline, we will.
Coastal First Nations were approached by Northern Gateway 9 years ago and asked whether or not we would approve tankers in the Great Bear. After investigating technology to clean up oil, which didn't exist and still doesn't, and looking in Valdez, Alaska to find out that the oil was still in the ground there, the Coastal First Nations declared a ban on tankers in the Great Bear Sea, and that ban will stay in effect forever.
The Burrard Inlet, bordering the northern edge of downtown Vancouver, British Columbia, is the home of three First Nations people, the Tsleil-Waututh, the Musqueam, and the Squamish. Once a verdant waterway, now industrial development sprawls across much of its southern shoreline.
The name we have, Tsleil-Waututh, means people of the inlet.
Carlene Thomas from the Tsleil-Waututh Nation.
Our elders taught us when the tide went out, the table was set. So our people really depended on the sustenance that the inlet provided for us.
We believe through our mythical stories that we invited the Salmon people to our territories.
Amanda Nahani is a member of the Squamish and Nisga Nations and climate and energy outreach campaigner for British Columbia Greenpeace.
So we feel that we have a sacred obligation to protect the Salmon people. We are connected to the eagle, to the raven, to the wolf, that these are our relatives.
Our ancestors describe this as the bosom of Mother Earth. When we go to these waters, we nourish ourselves as a mother does her child.
Ian Campbell, hereditary chief of the Squamish Nation in Vancouver, an elected counselor for the Squamish people.
Killer whales would come into Burrard Inlet and calve right next to where this Kinder Morgan terminal is.
There is currently a tar sands pipeline that's bringing tar sands to downtown Vancouver, British Columbia.
Matt Crow, SOS campaign director at Forest Ethics in Bellingham, Washington.
It's called the Trans Mountain Pipeline, and it's operated by Kinder Morgan, the folks who brought you Enron.
Kinder Morgan is currently going through a proposal to twin their existing pipeline, but we see it as a whole new project because it exponentially increases transporting diluted bitumen from the tar sands in Alberta to the West Coast to reach Asian markets.
The current pipeline is up to 300,000 barrels a day, most of it for consumption in Canada, some of it getting exported to the U.S. The new pipeline would roughly double that, another 590,000 barrels, all of it for export, all of it contributing to tanker traffic in Puget Sound and Salish Sea.
Trans Mountain Pipeline's been there since the 50s.
Bob Skinner, Canada School of Energy and the Environment.
It was expanded a few years ago through a World Heritage Site, Jasper National Park. There wasn't a ripple of noise from anybody. And so tankers have been coming and going for decades.
Just because we were willing to take a certain amount of risk decades ago to bring oil to our coast for our own consumption, that's a very different conversation than should we build a new pipeline to make billions of dollars for foreign oil interests.
Ben West, tar sands campaign director at Forest Ethics Advocacy, Vancouver.
When the pipeline was built in 1952, it was a very different province, and our understanding of climate change as well as many other environmental issues was not the same as it is today. The route that they're planning on putting the Kinder Morgan pipeline through is now the most densely populated parts of the province.
There's been tanker traffic going in and out of both sides of our border for 50 years.
Greg Stringham, Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers.
I think what the anxiety is, if it's going to be more, is this going to be more dangerous? And I think we've got to take a look at what they've learned in places like Valdez in Alaska, where they have world-class standards in place, unfortunately because of an incident, and make sure that those standards are in place in advance of the expansion.
The oil sands is expanding. Demand in Asia Pacific is expanding. They want the oil, and so natural commercial forces would say, well, let's get the oil to where the demand centers are.
What we focus on is transporting things for people. Our company is about moving commodities safely.
Mike Davies, Director of Marine Development at Kinder Morgan.
Oil companies don't exist as something outside of society to be vilified. They exist to satisfy demand that we all drive, and they also exist as a vehicle for investment.
We also see this opportunity to create jobs, to provide benefits to governments. Royalties and taxes that are paid to help with our social programs allows us to actually have a very beneficial trading relationship between Canada and the United States to help North America achieve this goal of energy self-sufficiency.
We've got a surplus of bitumen production at the moment.
Journalist Andrew Nikiforuk.
We've flooded the U.S. Midwest market with bitumen at the same time that American oil production has gone up and American demand for oil has gone down. It has nothing to do with energy security for North America. It's all about getting bitumen on super tankers so it can be upgraded and refined in Asia or taken to the U.S. Gulf Coast.
The price of oil in the international market, it's $20 to $30 higher than what it is in the continental U.S. And so that's a big piece of what this project is about, trying to diversify the Canadian markets, giving producers another place to be able to sell their oil. If we're going to produce oil and we're going to trade commodities as Canadians, I think it's important that we be able to get the best price that we can for it.
The proponents want to be able to move these products and get a return on their investment and profit substantially at the expense of everybody else.
Squamish Nation Chief Ian Campbell.
More than 70% of Canada's energy sector is not Canadian companies. It's others coming in and taking the benefits directly from Canadians, shipping it overseas, benefiting other multinational corporations and not keeping the dollars truly within our country.
Alberta is asking British Columbians to take all the risk and get nothing back in return. We want to put this 1,000-kilometer pipeline across some of the wildest rivers remaining in North America, some of the last best remaining salmon habitat in North America, across Aboriginal lands.
The Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline crosses about 1,000 different streams and rivers. And when it gets close to the coast, it goes through the pristine Great Bear Rainforest, teeming with life.
Ben West with Forest Ethics Advocacy Vancouver.
It's an area that many, many groups have been involved for years in a campaign to try to protect. And now all of a sudden, here's this proposal to bring a toxic oil pipeline right through the middle of it.
The proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline would terminate in Kitimat, on the far northern coast of British Columbia, where a supertanker terminal would be built.
You got to imagine the most beautiful fjord, glacier-capped mountains nearby, incredibly productive wildlife ecosystems, and now populate that fjord with rocks and islands and currents. Try threading through that entire area with a supertanker.
Matt Crow, Forest Ethics, Bellingham, Washington.
Enbridge created a promotional video that shows a supertanker leaving their proposed pipeline terminal, heading straight out through this open channel into the Pacific Ocean, and somehow they've failed to include the twists, the turns, the rocks, the islands, all the obstructions that are the reality of bringing a supertanker out through that kind of passage. There's absolutely no margin for error.
When oil is spilt into water, there's typically sort of three things happen. Some of it is dissolved into the water column. Some of it will begin to evaporate, and the oil that remains will float on the surface. The qualities of diluted bitumen, that it sinks to the bottom, it's not really true. Our experience has been that the existing equipment and conventional spill response techniques can recover bitumen.
Diluted bitumen spills are a fairly recent phenomenon, but experiences so far tend to refute the contention that bitumen spills are just like conventional crude oil spills. In the summer of 2010, another Enbridge pipeline in Michigan ruptured, spilling 4 million liters of bitumen into the Kalamazoo River.
Their technicians ignored the emergency alarms that were telling them there was a leak. That shift went home. They didn't even tell the next shift coming in that there was a leak going on.
Damian Gillis is a documentary filmmaker in Vancouver who publishes an online journal, The Common Sense Canadian.
It was local landowners that perceived the problem in their backyard and finally woke the company up to it. And it took something like 16 or 18 hours before they finally shut it off.
The Kalamazoo spill was the largest inshore oil spill in the history of the United States. The volatiles evaporated and the bitumen sank to the bottom of the Kalamazoo River.
We saw probably 1 million gallons coat about 35 miles of river bottom and wipe out the existing ecosystems. They're still dealing years later with the human health impacts.
Similar spill in Mayflower, Arkansas, where you had 22 homes flooded with bitumen and condensate. But here's an example of two companies running an extreme resource through pipelines more than 40 years old, jacking up the pressure to do so, and then creating disasters for two communities in the United States.
We've been moving diluted bitumen in the pipeline since 1985, and we haven't experienced any problems with moving dilbit or any integrity-related issues.
In order to move bitumen through pipelines, it needs to be diluted with a light hydrocarbon called a diluent. Before bitumen enters the pipeline, it is blended with benzene, naphtha, or condensate, a byproduct from producing fracked natural gas. The mix results in a viscous liquid that is 70% bitumen and 30% diluent.
The blend of the 30% diluent and the 70% bitumen becomes a homogeneous blend. It's not something like if you let it sit, it will then separate again.
Greg Stringham, Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers.
It's like making Kool-Aid. Once you mixed it, it stays the same way no matter what you do with it.
Look at the pictures in Kalamazoo and tell me that that was oil that was sticking together, or look at the readings that they got on the amount of benzene in the air in the community, which eventually led to hundreds of people being evacuated from their homes. A report just recently done actually by the government of Canada, who clearly has an interest in trying to make the case for the oil industry, showed that diluted bitumen does separate when it contacts sediment. There hasn't been a lot of research that's been done by anybody other than industry. It's hard to even get your hands on diluted bitumen because it's toxic and dangerous.
However, at the Cenovus Christina Lake facility near Fort McMurray, Alberta, where deep deposits of bitumen are extracted using a system called steam-assisted gravity drainage, a production engineer proudly fills a jar with black goopy dilbit that has just been produced and holds it up for us to see.
When it comes in, it's basically bitumen and water, so it's like an emulsion and it's really viscous. It's oil and pretty much diluent now. There should be no water in there. This is the money. This is why we're here.
Dilbit requires the importation of large volumes of condensate, a potentially carcinogenic product that comes with fracking in Northeast British Columbia and Alberta. Bitumen is harder on pipelines. It's more abrasive. You have tiny sand particles from the oil sands that remains in the product.
Pipeline transportation is very safe. It's the safest way to move the petroleum that our economy runs on. We've been operating the Trans Mountain Pipeline for 60 years, and there's about 72 spills. Most of them are small. They're usually in our terminals.
None of them, I would suggest, are small. It takes only a tiny drop of oil to contaminate a significant body of fresh water.
In this little suburban community of Burnaby on the Salish Sea, an arm of the Trans Mountain Pipeline ruptured and was sending a spout of oil with bitumen in it right up into the residential neighborhood.
Eric DePlace, Policy Director at Sightline Institute, Seattle.
They had another mishap, too, at a tank farm not too far from there.
When the Trans Mountain Pipeline was first built, the voices of today's leading pipeline critics, the First Nations, were prevented from having a say. The Indian Act of 1876 prevented First Nations people from hiring lawyers to pursue Aboriginal land claims. Some of these laws remained in effect until the 1980s. But because First Nation land in British Columbia is unceded, never lost in battle or signed away in treaties, the federal government must consult with First Nations in BC before going forward with any development which impacts their lands, such as a pipeline or a supertanker terminal.
As First Nations people have taken various development projects to court, the right to consultation and the right to the land has been upheld over and over again. A declaration has now been signed by over 160 First Nations groups that says the pipeline is not permitted through their territories.
The First Nations people who have signed onto the Save the Fraser Declaration agree to take every legal action possible to stop any project that harms the Fraser River. This includes not only the Enbridge Pipeline, but also the Trans Mountain Pipeline. They are joined in their opposition by British Columbia's municipal leaders.
The mayors of Burnaby and Vancouver both made very strong stands publicly against this pipeline. That doesn't square with the overwhelming voice of the federal government and our province.
Canada is a mining republic.
Andrew Nikiforik.
We cut down trees, we dig up nickel, we dig up uranium, but we've never before become a major oil exporting nation. And now that we supply the United States with a third of its oil, we can begin to see dramatic changes in how Canadians talk about themselves, govern themselves, even the lies they tell to themselves.
Here in Canada, we have one of the most robust regulatory environments.
Dan Wicklum with the Canadian Oil Sands Innovation Alliance.
We have the Migratory Bird Protection Act, we have the Canada Water Act, the Fisheries Act, the Canadian Environmental Protection Act. And from my experience in the government of Canada, I would put it on par with any other country in the world.
We've always needed better environmental protections in Canada, but what little we did have has been actively dismantled.
Filmmaker Damian Gillis.
We have seen the dismantling of an unprecedented list of different federal environmental protections, budgets for fisheries officers, environmental officers, monitoring and enforcement is going out the window. It's being described as a war on science.
The Prime Minister silenced all of the scientists who said that this project was endangering the environment.
Art Sterrett is the director of the Coastal First Nations.
They gutted every bit of environmental legislation that was in the way of these pipes.
The Canadian Environmental Assessment Act was totally rewritten to accommodate industry and to make it easier to build pipelines and to build oil sands projects.
We had our world-class ocean pollution monitoring program completely shut down. And we're giving away a lot of our controls through trade agreements.
The Fisheries Act, which is our oldest piece of environmental legislation, more than 100 years old, designed to protect fish habitat, was totally rewritten. The government said, well, you only need to protect commercially important fish, forgetting, of course, that commercially important fish eat other fish that aren't commercially important. It's a remarkable transformation for a country that once prided itself on some truly unique scientific achievements.
There's so much money coming out of the oil and gas industry here that they're able to influence elections, they're able to influence candidates and then public policy once they're in office. These changes to our environmental laws are actually being written by the oil and gas industry.
I and others have a lot of concern that this isn't just about this one pipeline.
Ben West, Forest Ethics Advocacy, Vancouver.
It's also about opening up much of that area that has been the focus of a campaign for many, many years to protect, to all kinds of other mining projects, all kinds of other development projects.
Ultimately, all of these questions are infrastructure questions. They're questions about whether there will be an actual pipeline, whether we will allow rail terminals.
Eric DePlace, Sightline Institute, Seattle.
The problem for the oil industry is that as cavalier as they can seem about these questions, they actually don't have answers to those infrastructure questions.
One of the things that's been said in British Columbia repeatedly is that the politicians issue the permits, but the people give permission, and the people are not giving permission for these pipelines to be built. There was a call to action that was put out by one of the First Nations groups in BC asking for supporters who would join them in civil disobedience or direct action to try to peacefully stop these pipelines from moving forward. I think it was within 2 days they had something like 15, 20,000 people had signed up.
For First Nations, the biggest hammer that we wield is uncertainty for government and business.
Squamish Chief Ian Campbell.
Their legitimacy to unilaterally proclaim that they have full jurisdiction is at question because of Supreme Court cases that have come out of Canada affirming that Aboriginal rights and title certainly exists. That uncertainty really then challenges the Crown's authority to just arbitrarily allow these projects to go through without full consultation with Indigenous peoples and accommodation of our interests.
Some people would have to say, well, I don't want to see this development at all. And those people say, I would rather not use oil, I would rather use some other form of energy. And that's their choice.
Greg Stringham, Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers.
But in order to be able to actually have the industry be able to develop and supply the needs for everyone that's choosing to use oil these days, we need to be able to make sure that we do that in a responsible manner.
The Canadian oil industry claims to be reducing the environmental footprint of tar sands extraction by shifting from open-pit mining to in-situ operations. Only 20% of the bitumen in Alberta is close enough to the surface to be mined. The only way to access the rest of the reserves is to heat up the bitumen so that it can flow to a well. In the 1980s, a new method called steam-assisted gravity drainage, or SAGD, was developed, drilling horizontal wells in pairs that access a broader radius of oil reserves than vertical drilling. The industry claims that SAGD's smaller surface footprint reduces the environmental impacts of extracting bitumen.
We're proposing to put all these steam plants all over the place where we use natural gas to boil water, inject it under the ground to melt the bitumen over a period of time, and then to pump it back to the surface. Well, that requires roads and seismic lines and pipelines. We're really proposing to industrialize an area the size of Florida.
On a cluster of computer screens in a tower a couple stories above the well pad, we watch the drill bit as it follows the layer of bitumen.
The third part of the well is actually where they're drilling in the oil sands, the money zone, where they drill straight laterally.
Josh Baranowski is a driller coordinator for the Cenovus Christina Lake SAGD operation.
Now, the reason they drill in pairs, the first one is the producer well, that's what produces the oil. The next one, they drill right beside it, the injector they're pumping the steam into, the steam grows in a big chamber and melts everything, they suck it out of the bottom one.
This year is the first year where the oil production from in-situ operations was more than mining.
Dan Wicklum, Canadian Oil Sands Innovation Alliance.
And I think that would just inherently decrease the amount of disturbance per barrel of oil.
In the in-situ areas, you see a very small land disturbance, somewhere between 10 and 15% of the total land area.
They don't talk about the truck traffic, the roads, the seismic lines, the pipelines required, and they're not talking about the enormous footprint required to bring natural gas to this region and to use natural gas on a phenomenal scale.
I think that any type of resource extraction has a footprint. The goal is to do that as absolutely as responsibly as possible, and to challenge yourself as a sector to do it better and better and better every darn day.
We are already up against and maybe beyond the allowable limits of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. If we're going to have any hope of a sane or stable climate in the future, it's imperative that we stop activating huge sources of carbon reserves in the middle of our continent.
They have a political agenda, which is very much about getting the world off oil.
Bob Skinner, Canada School of Energy and the Environment.
But they don't seem to be telling the world what the world would do when it gets off oil.
When we're confronted with this argument that we need the oil, or we need the gas, or we need the coal, there's something that's right about that argument. We are still living in an energy economy that has a large fossil fuel component to it. At the same time, it is critical that we recognize that we need clean air, we need clean water, we need, and I mean need, a stable climate in the future, or we're not going to have a place that anybody's going to want to live.
Woe behold the politician who would do anything to increase the price of mobility and convenience and electricity. But study after study has shown that unless you price transportation or mobility, we'll never do anything about it.
The best and most rational way to do this is to begin to reduce the grotesque subsidies that we provide to the fossil fuel industry and put a price on carbon pollution. This isn't ultimately a fight about this terminal or that pipeline. It's really a fight about whether we can get our national governments to begin to stop shoveling taxpayer dollars into the pockets of Houston and Alberta and oil men and begin to put a sensible price on carbon pollution.
As the storms become more severe and as the climate becomes more unpredictable and as we see more multi-billion dollar infrastructure damage, we're going to put a price on carbon. A good, reasonable price on carbon will make the tar sands a very marginal product.
Don't let people say we have met the enemy and it is us. It is not.
Kathleen Dean Moore is an environmental writer in Corvallis, Oregon.
The enemy is the business plan of corporations who will make a fortune by making us have very few alternatives as to how we live.
When we began this journey 9 years ago, it was all about a pipeline.
Art Sherritt, Coastal First Nations.
It's become much more than that. It's now about democracy. All of the institutions that have been built over the last 150 years that respected the environment, that respected science, that respected our courts, all of this is being destroyed by this government in the name of big oil.
Fighting Goliath was written, narrated, and produced by Barbara Bernstein and is a production of The Media Project and Feather and Fin Productions. Original music was composed and performed by Barbara Bernstein and Bob Bernstein. Jerry Mayer, Melissa Marsland, Hallie Blashfield, and Kathleen Sadat were editing consultants. Additional audio was provided by Borg Hendrickson, Montana Public Radio, Radio Free Moscow, Boise State Public Radio, Michael Gaskill, Zachary Johnson, and Wild Idaho Rising Tide. Special thanks to Jerry Mayer, Kathleen Sadat, Melissa Marsland, Hallie Blashfield, Clark Salisbury, Andrew Nikiforik, Zach Porter, Bob Gentry, Onyx Smith, Steve Hawley, Bork Hendrickson, Lynn Lahey, The Reflections Inn, Eric DePlace, Ben West, Damian Gillis, Elizabeth Austin, Synovus Energy, and Radio Free Moscow. This program was made possible with funding from the Regional Arts and Culture Council, the Fund for Investigative Journalism, and Oregon Humanities, an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Fighting Goliath is available on CD from Feather and Fin Productions, P.O. Box 82777, Portland, Oregon 97282. That's Feather and Fin Productions, P.O. Box 82777, Portland, Oregon 97282. CDs are $12. You can also purchase them on our website, mediaprojectonline.org/fightinggoliath, where you can learn more about the tar sands and the communities affected by tar sands development. Yeah.